This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
In April last year, this programme looked at events in Sudan, where two rival armed groups seemed to be in the early stages of a civil war that the Sudanese people didn't want and seemed powerless to stop. Things were bleak then. Now, it seems, they're desperate. Millions are displaced or refugees, thousands are dead, and the prospect of famine is real. So what exactly has happened in the last year? How bad might things get? And what's the international community doing to try and resolve the situation? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, a reminder of how this current conflict started and a briefing on how it's developed. The briefing room's Ben Carter spoke to James Cotnell, who presents Newsday on the BBC World Service and was formerly our correspondent in Sudan.
Firstly, James, just remind us where Sudan is, how big it is and who its neighbours are.
Sudan is one of the biggest countries in Africa. It used to be the biggest, actually, until South Sudan seceded in 2011. It sort of bridges the Arab world, North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. It's seen as a gateway to different parts of the continent. It's got Egypt and Libya to the north, Chad to the west, South Sudan to the south, Ethiopia to the east, some of its major neighbours. It's a very strategic position in the continent. It's been a place that has seen conflict for many years, but has also been seen at other times as an agricultural breadbasket for North Africa or even for the Arab world.
And before we talk about this current conflict, Sudan isn't a stranger to civil wars, is it?
No, the entire history since independence in 1956 and even before has just been marked by conflict. So there were two very long-running North-South civil wars that resulted in millions of deaths and led in 2011 to South Sudan seceding, splitting away. In 2003, a civil war broke out in Darfur in the west of the country, and it's still unresolved to this day. And then there have been other conflicts in the east of Sudan, in the Nuba Mountains, in the Blue Nile. So there's hardly been a day of peace in those almost seven decades of independence.
And looking at this current conflict, what caused it? And just remind us who's fighting who here.
So the war is between the Sudanese military, the Sudanese armed forces, on the one hand, and their former allies, the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF. That's a paramilitary group. And it grew out of the Janjaweed, the really feared Arab militias that fought in the Darfur civil war on the side of the Sudanese military that later became formalised as the RSF. And those two groups carried out a coup against a civilian-led government. And then since April of last year, they've been fighting amongst themselves for essentially control of the state, for its resources, for the ability to rule the country. And it's been an incredibly devastating conflict. Millions of people displaced, millions of people facing famine, and with little sign of a solution up until now.
Now, Sudan's an Islamic country. Is religion part of this dispute, and is one side more Islamist than the other?
It's not the biggest factor by any means. Almost everyone in Sudan now is Muslim. Some people believe in political Islam, in Islamism. And that was the defining ideology of Omar al-Bashir, who ruled the country from 1989 for almost 30 years until he was overthrown by popular protests. And lots of people then wanted the Islamists out. Now, some people in Sudan, many people in Sudan, think that that old Islamist elite, the old people aligned to Omar al-Bashir, are still close to and maybe even directing the Sudanese armed forces. But the fighting is, I think, much more about who is in control of the country than some big, broad political vision.
Now, the last time we spoke to you about this was in April last year when fighting had just broken out in Khartoum. What's happened since then?
Much more fighting, much more destruction, much more devastation. We've seen heavy combat in the capital Khartoum and around it, in Al Jazeera, which is the agricultural area to the south, which is having a huge impact on food production, in Kordofan to the west, and most notably perhaps in Darfur, in the far west of the country. Now, the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, has been accused by a number of international bodies of committing genocide there by targeting black African Darfuris and killing them, raping women, killing men, particularly near the town of El Geneina. There is ongoing fighting right now with the RSF besieging the city of El Fasher. That's the last major urban centre in Darfur, still under control of the Sudanese military. There have been a number of attempts to bring the warring parties together with no success. Negotiations have essentially gone nowhere. And as the conflict has continued, there is now a very pressing threat of famine. Some people say it could be the worst famine for 40 years.
Before I talk to you about the humanitarian situation a bit more, has either side got the upper hand in this conflict, would you say?
Well, for many months, the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, seemed to have the upper hand. They controlled most of the capital. They have taken almost all of Darfur, apart from the city of El Fasher and some of the surrounding areas. They took control of Jazeera State, which is the agricultural area, lots of Kordofan too. But in recent times, the Sudanese military has struck back a little bit, retaking some territory in Jazeera, retaking parts of Omdurman, which is the sister city of the capital, Khartoum, and making a couple of gains elsewhere. And I think the key point is that both sides feel that they could win, and so they're not really open to negotiations, whatever they might say publicly. Despite the fact that Sudanese history shows that nobody ever really wins a war in Sudan, it may last many decades, it may cost millions of lives, but in the end, ultimately, there's a negotiated solution. Both sides aren't willing to accept that right now.
And on the humanitarian situation, do we have any idea about how many people have died and how many people have been displaced?
I don't think there's a credible estimate, really, for the number of people who have died. The UN panel of experts looking into that alleged genocide carried out by the RSF in West Darfur last year said in just that incident, 10 to 15,000 people might have been killed. So it's very, very plausible that tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, civilians and others, have been killed in this conflict. But there's no real credible estimate for that. We do know much more about the numbers of people who've been displaced. So within the country, there are 10 million displaced people, including some from previous conflicts, but more than 7 million since the start of the war in April last year. And more than 2 million people have fled over the border as refugees into Chad, into South Sudan, into Ethiopia, into Egypt and elsewhere. So huge numbers of the country's population have been forced to flee.
James, do you get a sense that the worst is yet to come in this conflict?
Sadly, I think there is that sense that things are going to get much, much worse. The fighting continues. Neither side wants to stop. Harvests have been missed. People are dying already of hunger. the statistics of showing malnutrition and other worrying numbers are very high throughout the country. We talked to one expert who said that by September, 70% of the country will be hungry. 2.5 million people could die in the next few months alone from hunger. Perhaps that number could even go up as 4 million. And it seems almost too late to stop it. There's no real effort to push food to people who desperately need it or to get the warring parties to stop fighting. So, yeah, I think it probably is going to get a lot worse.
And just finally, do you get the sense in the international community, because we've got conflicts going on in Gaza and conflict going on in Ukraine, that this has almost become a forgotten war?
Sudanese say that it's not a forgotten war, it's a war that's being ignored, that people are simply turning their back on their suffering. There is perhaps a belated recognition internationally about the scale of the disaster here. So you saw, for example, the G7, the group of powerful economies, the leaders from the G7, when they met in Italy recently, they put out a warning about foreign countries intervening in the conflict in Sudan. We've heard warnings from the United Nations and others about the risks of famine and of millions of people dying. But yeah, there isn't a strong international push to resolve the conflict in the way there is in Gaza, say. There isn't the attention that's given to Ukraine. And as a result of that, the war is going to continue and many more people are going to die.
Ben Carter talking to James Copnell. So what's life like for people currently living in Sudan? Joining me now is BBC journalist Mo Hashim, who has family there. Mo Hashim, you have family in Sudan. Where are they? And have they been displaced or are they in their homes?
Most of my family has been displaced. I still have cousins in Omdurman and some family in the north in Adbara and in Berber. And a few in Port Sudan, but the majority have made their way across to Egypt, and some have found a refuge in Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates.
So they're all over the place, the ones outside Sudan. The ones in Sudan, what are they telling you about the situation for them?
The living conditions are very difficult. The cost of surviving is very high. Those who had to flee Khartoum to places outside are talking of exorbitant rents being taken from them. The people who are still stranded are struggling to find decent food. They'll struggle to make a meal a day. Those who have children are struggling with them because they're, in effect, are part of 19 million Sudanese school children who haven't had any form of schooling for the last 15 months. So they are talking about very difficult conditions, and some who have infants are struggling to get the things that they need for their babies, be it milk or kind of like medicines, and it's a nightmare. I mean, I was speaking to some cousins in Omdurman over Eid, which was just last week, and they're saying that, for example, the indiscriminate shelling that's been ongoing over the past couple of weeks is making it a nightmare because you're not quite sure where to go to do your shopping and who's hitting you and who's targeting you. So it's quite a dark existence.
So they're shelling. Have they actually seen troops and armed people on the streets?
Oh, yes, definitely. The areas that are controlled by the Sudanese army, you constantly see presence of soldiers on the streets. And some of these residential areas often frequently become sort of like battlegrounds themselves. And we only need to keep in mind that parts of old Omdurman were only recently liberated. So it was a very hot battle zone in around April and March. This week, we've been fighting in the southeast of the country, as well as, of course, the fighting that's ongoing in Darfur, in and around the city of Al-Fashir in North Darfur. So Sudan is a vast country, the size of Eastern Europe. So you can imagine there is this war in Romania, but there is war in around the Czech Republic, and there is a battle happening at around the Balkans. This is the spread of this. And with the land in effect being de facto divided between two areas of control, one controlled by the army and one controlled by the RSF, it's very difficult for people living in both areas. But generally, people are trying to flee the areas that are controlled by the RSF to areas that are controlled by the army because they feel safer.
Do your family have any kind of notion that one side is winning over the other?
I was talking to an uncle of mine who was in Khartoum, and Khartoum is controlled by the RSF. It took him about 4 days to take his elderly mother and his children to get out of Khartoum and go to a city in the north of Sudan. And he was telling me that the fear that he encountered just traveling across and seeing the large numbers of RSF soldiers in parts of Khartoum gave him the feeling that now it's time to get out, because this war, seemingly as how he sees it, is going to go on for a long time. So it is not clear how militarily this war is going to be resolved, if ever. The balance between the two forces and the shifting dynamics, you can discern that there might be a strategy followed by the generals in the army who are trying to at least rout the RSF out of the capital and the surrounding regions. But thus far, that has proven to be a very difficult goal to achieve. And over the coming weeks, Sudan is going to go into its rainy season. Sudan makes the nature of military operations very difficult for both sides. So it seems that before both sides are stuck, they're trying to both kind of like strengthen their hands, as it were.
Mo Hashim, and just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking what Macron's gamble means for France, the one about the risk posed by ransomware attacks, and the one about why the water industry is in so much trouble.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Back to Sudan and its future. Joining me now in the briefing room are Dame Rosalind Marsden, Associate Fellow at the Chatham House International Affairs Think Tank in London and a former UK ambassador to Sudan, and Professor Alex de Waal, who is Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation. Alex de Waal, we've heard James Cottnell telling us about the humanitarian crisis in Sudan. Perhaps you could give us an idea of just how big an issue it is.
The entire country is in food crisis, which means that people don't have enough to eat. About half the country is in what food security specialists call food emergency, and that means young children are beginning to die from malnutrition. And we see large parts of it descending into what we call food catastrophe, where death rates are really elevated. Now, there's a bit of a data vacuum, and the data is highly politicized. There are some who want to deny the existence or the extent or the severity of this crisis. But I've been studying famine in Sudan for 40 years, and it's never been as bad as this in my professional career.
Alex, why would anybody want to deny the scale of the crisis? Who wants to deny it?
Both the warring parties want to deny it in their own different ways. So the rapid support forces are really a looting machine. Everywhere they go, they're like a swarm of locusts, and they strip out everything. And they don't want that, which is essentially a war crime, to be highlighted. Meanwhile, the Sudan armed forces headed by General Burhan, which is recognized by the United Nations, though not by many others, as the legitimate government, it's losing the war, and its most effective weapon for holding its ground and possibly beginning to gain ground, its most effective weapon is starvation. Blocking all supplies, and especially humanitarian supplies, going into the areas controlled by the RSF. And it's not going to hand over that card easily. And if the United Nations were to declare famine, it would be under a lot more pressure to permit aid into those areas. So it wants to deny the seriousness of the crisis.
That's very interesting. And what you've also highlighted there is the fact that these things are almost certainly war crimes, in which case the question of the international reaction to those war crimes comes into play.
We call it a man-made famine, gendered language deliberate. It is the women who bear the burden of families surviving. It's a man-made famine, and we know the men who are making it. And the International Court actually has a mandate going back 19 years for investigating Darfur, which is where the worst of the famine is happening. And it would not be difficult for the prosecutor to identify the tactics which are unlawful, which are being used by generals on both sides, and bring charges against them, summon them to the International Criminal Court to face trial for these crimes.
Can we just talk about food aid for a moment? As far as you're aware, is any food aid arriving in Sudan? Who's providing it and where's it getting to?
Some aid is coming. There is a single access line permitted into Darfur, but that has been closed recently and only a trickle is coming. More aid is coming from Port Sudan, which is the interim headquarters of the government, into the government-controlled areas. But there are two major problems here. One is that all the neighboring countries are themselves facing food crises. South Sudan is also facing famine. Chad, Ethiopia is in a bad state. And so there aren't sort of buffer stocks in neighboring regions that can be easily drawn upon. And the other is that despite the fact that this food crisis was foreseen more than a year ago, only a small fraction of the assistance needed has actually been mobilized by international donors up to now. If you look at the UN's financial tracking service, they say that less than 20% of the money they appealed for back in January has actually been delivered. There are a lot more pledges, but they don't count the pledges until the money or the food is actually in their accounts. So the international response has been desperately slow.
Rosalind Marsden, we've heard there Alex de Waal talking about the international response in terms of aid. How would you describe the political aspects of the international response to the situation in Sudan?
Well, I think 14 months into the war, Sudan hasn't received anywhere near as much high-level political attention or international media attention as it deserves, given the gravity of the crisis. There was quite a lot of ministerial-level and media attention focused on Sudan at the time of the evacuation flights for British diplomats and British nationals. That was back in April last year. But after that, interest sharply sort of tailed off. Part of the problem seems to be that it's been very difficult for international journalists to actually get inside the country and get footage of what's happening. A few have done so in more recently. And of course, Sudanese journalists and civil society have been doing their very best to ensure the situation in their country is not forgotten. But international media coverage is in no way comparable to that given to other major conflicts. This raises questions about perceived double standards in dealing with different global crises, particularly conflicts in Africa. Now, obviously, Ukraine and Gaza are a major global crises, but what is perhaps surprising is that 20 years ago, Darfur did attract a great deal of international attention. This was at the time of the Save Darfur Coalition, when celebrities like George Clooney or the then Senator Barack Obama were involved. And indeed, David Cameron visited Darfur back in those days. And this was despite other global crises at the time, such as Iraq and Afghanistan.
At one level, this seems inexplicable. I mean, though at another level, you might say that the other crises have detracted from it. But what actually has the United Nations been doing and saying about Sudan?
Well, because the United Nations Security Council is divided over Sudan, with obvious tensions at the moment between Russia and the P3, US, UK, France, it's taken the UN Security Council almost a year to pass its first resolution. And that was back in March this year, calling for a Ramadan ceasefire, a call which was totally ignored. This month, the Security Council passed another resolution calling, among other things, for the Rapid Support Force to end its siege of Al-Fasher, the capital of North Darfur. And that also hasn't had much impact so far. I think it's worth recalling that the UN mission in Sudan, UNITAMS, was terminated at the end of last year at the insistence of the UN-recognised de facto authorities in Port Sudan, who still occupy Sudan's seat in the UN Security Council, despite having conducted a coup against the civilian government in October 2021. And it was also they who drove out the special representative of the Secretary General in June last year, after which the United Nations was largely sidelined on the political front. A few months ago, the Secretary General appointed Ramtane Lamamra, who was a former Algerian foreign minister, to be his personal envoy. He's been apparently working behind the scenes to try to bring more coherence into the various mediation initiatives. But the UN humanitarian coordinator is now based in Port Sudan. She's been trying to press for greater humanitarian access, but with limited success so far because she's constrained by having to work with the de facto authorities there.
Are there any other people trying to mediate in the Sudanese situation?
Yes. I mean, outside Sudan, apart from the United Nations, I mean, we've got the United States, the UK, the European Union, and a number of regional African and Arab organisations who've all been trying to get involved. Perhaps highlighting the United States and Saudi Arabia, they have sponsored a series of peace talks in Jeddah to try to secure a cessation of hostilities and improved humanitarian access. But we saw from their efforts last summer and again in November last year that they failed to secure any sort of lasting ceasefire or any real improvement in humanitarian access. There were a number of very short-term ceasefires were agreed to, but they were broken almost immediately by both sides, partly because there was no effective monitoring mechanism on the ground. Also, commitments that were given by both sides to protect civilians were completely ignored. The US and Saudi Arabia are now trying to resume those talks in an expanded format, perhaps involving the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, plus the African Union and IGAD, the sub-regional organisation. But these talks are currently stalled as both belligerents still seem to be looking for a military solution, with the Sudanese armed forces in particular reluctant to return to the negotiating table until they've improved their military position.
Right. Alex de Wael, one of the things we know about the politics of the region in the last few years is that the Gulf states have been more heavily involved than one might have supposed. Has there been any kind of significant role for, say, Saudi Arabia and the UAE in what's been going on in Sudan? And if so, what have they been doing?
Well, I think we need to see the whole of Northeast Africa, the Horn of Africa, the Nile Valley, as part of the strategic perimeter of the Red Sea states and the Gulf states. So it is the politics of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, to some extent Turkey as well, that is actually not so much driving the conflict as obstructing the solution to the conflict. So the UAE has been arming the rapid support forces. There's no doubt about that. Its diplomats deny it, but their denial does not carry credibility. The Saudis lean the other way. They are more sympathetic to SAF. But the key issue here is that the Saudis and the Emiratis are rivals for dominating the region as a whole. The Saudis feel that the Emiratis have sort of muscled their way into the Saudi backyard, which is the Red Sea, with commercial, with strategic investments in ports and so on. So the Saudis don't want to see the Emiratis running away with Sudan. And while the Emiratis do not want to see the Saudis presiding over a solution to the Sudanese conflict. And while that dynamic remains, frankly, all the mediation efforts are being going just going round and round in circles and not achieving anything. And that also means that the United States, which has put this file in its Africa Bureau, doesn't really get the time of day in either Riyadh or Abu Dhabi. The American agenda with Saudi Arabia and the UAE has many, many other issues, you know, starting with Gaza, with Iran, with Russia, with maritime and financial issues. And Sudan, frankly, just doesn't get a look in except as a footnote, perhaps at the end of the meeting as they are walking out of the door. And so that renders the idea of African solutions, frankly, irrelevant. And until the Gulf states actually begin to see either that they could agree or that their failure to agree is going to unleash a catastrophe, which will have implications for their own security, their own economy, for migration, and for their reputations, which is perhaps what they care about more than anything else. Until that happens, I fear that we are just going to be going round in circles and watching Sudan burn and the Sudanese people starve.
Alistair Wall there with Rosalind Marsden. My thanks to them and to James Copnell and Mo Hashim. My conclusion, well, we're all about to be asked for our help in getting urgent aid to the Sudanese people, and now you know why. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirsty Knight and Ben Carter. The editor was Richard Varden and the studio engineers were Rod Farker and Andy Fell. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Communicating with me, Ros Atkins. This is the podcast where I talk to some of the best communicators, like legendary magazine editor Tina Brown, the Olympic athlete and broadcaster Michael Johnson, to find out why good communication really matters and how best to do it. Have you ever walked out of a meeting and thought, why didn't I make the impact that I'd intended to? Or perhaps you've put down the phone to the bank without getting the answer you wanted. We all have dozens of interactions every day, and this series will provide you with practical advice for communicating effectively during them. Communicating with Ros Atkins. Listen and subscribe on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Der Kick der Woche mit warmen Looks für kalte Tage.
So viel mehr Wohlfühlmode.
Mit Damenhausslipper, je 5,99 Euro.
Und so viel mehr für die Piste.
Mit Kinder-Skijacken oder Hosen ab 12,99 Euro. Nur jetzt und nur bei Kick. Mehr als du denkst.